Hey out there, rock and rollers, welcome to the 132nd edition of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, brought to you by me, your host, Mac B. the Wolf, and I will be joined, as usual, by my partner in crime from the East Coast of the U.S., Gary Action Jackson, and we appreciate you guys supporting us. You know, it means the world to us that you all tune into our show each and every week. The month of May was great for us. We had a great run there. Of course, we had the two live reviews of Metallica kicking off their M72 World Tour in Amsterdam. It was great to be back in Amsterdam and great to have the opportunity to share the highlights with you there. And having Scott Holiday of Rival Sons on was fantastic. Such a cool guy. Such a badass new album, Dark Fighter, which is out now. You guys, if you're looking for new music and it's hard for you to find it, don't hesitate. Go get Dark Fighter by Rival Sons. I think you'll dig it. And you can listen to our episode 130 when we talk with him about touring and about the new album, Super Guy. And just glad that Rival Sons is in the rotation for us now. Of course, after that, we had a great talk with Terry Reed and George K. of Cosmic American Derelict. So we're on a bit of a roll here with some great guests and some great shows. And we thank you for supporting us. And we think you're going to like what we have in store for you here today, because today we have a fellow podcaster on, but also an author of a book that maybe you might overlook if you just saw it in the bookstore or saw it scrolling through Amazon.com. But I'm telling you, if you're a rock history fan, if you're a rock technology fan, you're going to like The Tormato Story by Kevin Mulry. Kevin is an Englishman, lives in the Midlands, and has for about a dozen years now been doing the Yes Music podcast. And he's had most every living member of the band on, even some are now no longer with us, and done over 600 episodes, just diving deep, deep down into every little niche aspect of the band. It shows he has a lot of passion and a lot of knowledge, and he loves to share it with folks all around the world. I was recently listening to him interview John Davidson, their lead singer, about Mirror to the Sky, their new album, and thought it was great. And when I found out he was releasing this book, The Tormato Story, about the 1978 album, which is not everyone's favorite. I mean, it went platinum in the U.S., but didn't have any huge hits. Don't Kill the Whale was a bit of a hit, but usually isn't in a Yes fan's top five albums of all time. And to the casual rock and roll fan, they might not even know the Tormato exists. So when I found there was a book on Tormato, I'm like, huh, well, that's interesting. Kevin was good enough to send us some advanced copies. And I got to tell you, I love reading this book. It has so much intimate detail about the band being in AdVision and RAC Studios in London, where they took the pictures in Regent's Park for the back cover, the instruments everybody used, how they made some of the instruments. The Birotron, which was something that Rick Wakeman had invested heavily in that was supposed to replace the Mellotron. Unbelievable detail he goes into. The amount of research is amazing. And the photos that they have, because he got a friend who was there in 1978, who got Mickey Mouse to let him in to Rag Studios and walk around a little bit, also equally amazing because they cleaned him up and you can really see some detail that no one's ever seen before. So even if it's not your favorite album, even if Yes isn't your favorite band, I think you'll like this book, and I think you'll like the conversation we had with Kevin talking about the research he did and some of the fine points that he came up with for the Tormato story. So we're going to jump into that here very shortly. Just a little bit of business first. First, we have to mention that we are proud members of the Pantheon Podcast Network, which is a network of about 100 different music shows, not all rock and roll. There really is something in there for everyone, and you can follow them at Pantheon Pods or PantheonPodcast.com. We actually recently made their top 20 most listened to shows, and so again, we have to thank you for that. And to help us find other rock and roll fans like you, other potential listeners, please consider going out and giving us a positive review wherever you get your podcast. Doesn't really matter where, but wherever you like to listen, wherever you download, subscribe, just take a couple minutes, give us a positive review. It's a huge help to us, and it helps us find more rock fans like you. And of course, we have to mention our fantastic sponsors, RareVinyl.com. Guys, based in the UK, Rare Vinyl has over 250,000 items in stock, including a lot of Yes items. They have stuff from all over the world, and they ship it all over the world. And you can trust these guys. First of all, look, I've been to their operation. I've met their team. They take great care in procuring and shipping all of your stuff all around the world. They've been doing it for 40 years. They've got a 5-star rating from Trust Radius. And right now, if you use the code UGLY, you can save 10% off your orders. Now, I know Father's Day is coming up. Maybe you go in there and find that rare thing, whether it's a first edition or it's a tour program or it's a poster from a record store from back in the day. Whatever it is you're looking for, they probably have it. They've got something you're going to want. So go to rarevinyl.com, use the code UGLY, and save yourself 10%. Tell your loved ones, for Father's Day, don't get me a damn tie. Get me something I want from rarevinyl.com. And use code UGLY, you'll save yourself 10%. Now back to the Toromato story. In-depth read. I really wish I had gotten it before I moved out of London, because I would have spent a little bit more time at each one of these spots to better understand how they made this music and who was doing it and when. This may not be my favorite, and it's wedged between a couple that I actually like in Going for the One and Drama, but that's okay. This is how you learn and get a better understanding for music, is by talking and sharing with people who have that passion and that deep knowledge like Kevin does for Yes and Toromato. So without further ado, let's jump in. We're talking to Kevin Mulryan, co-host of the Yes Music Podcast and author of the new book, The Toromato Story, right here on The Wolf.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Welcome to the Ugly American Werewolf in London, although we are stateside now.
Yes.
And where are you, in the Midlands?
Yes, I'm right in the middle of the country, in Stratford-on-Avon.
Oh, very nice. Shakespeare country.
Indeed, yes.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, I first of all, I want to congratulate you on your show. I mean, we're pretty proud that we've been going 2.5 years here, but the Yes Music Podcast is, what, 12 years in the making? It's incredible.
Yeah, it's been quite a thing. It's one of those things that the reason it's gone on so long, in a way, is because I haven't stopped doing it. You know, you just you get into a process and into a schedule of weekly episodes, and you just keep going and keep going. And since Mark Anthony came, my co-host has come on as well. That makes it a lot easier when you've got someone, as you, I'm sure you know, when you've got someone else to bounce off.
That's
really
right.
Really helpful. So we've been doing that for several years, but yeah, August 2011 we started.
Wow. And then you'll have more than 600 episodes, a weekly show with more than 600 episodes. And of course, you've had so many characters from the Yes world on over the years, of course, including members of the band, which has got to be a dream come true. I mean, still to this day, even though you've been doing this long and you've got this great collection and you've met them over the years, it's still got to be great to be able to have a little one-on-one interaction with them. Steve Howe or John Davidson or whomever over the years.
Yeah, it's been great. We've managed to get hold of most of the members of the band, and we're very, very happy to have been able to speak to Alan White, for example, mm-hmm. About a year before he died. So that was fantastic, and Tony Kaye and John Anderson and various others, including the current members. And it's, mm-hmm. Yes, it's a privilege, and they've always been absolutely delightful to us. But we've also enjoyed as you say, talking to all those people, you know, for example, for the research for the book, all those mm-hmm. people who don't generally get remembered. So it's been brilliant to talk to all sorts of people and people like us, people like who are huge fans of the band, but have in-depth knowledge as well.
Absolutely. No. And this book about Tormato, which we're going to have to get into, we're going to have to dive into. I appreciate you sending us some copies for us to peruse before we get on with you here. But I really wish, because I lived in London for 3.5 years, and I wish I'd received this book maybe more than a year ago before I moved away, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, obviously, I've been out in front of RIK. I lived in St. John's Wood. I lived less than a mile from RIK.
Yeah.
That picture I took of Mickey Most, his blue plaque there,
yeah,
I would pass by that about once a week. You know, I would drop my daughter off at school, and then I'd go to Regent's Park with the dog or to get some exercise or whatever. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's where Mickey Most did some of his damage in there, without knowing the full, you know, story. Or what is it, the Macclesfield Bridge? I don't know. It wasn't the main bridge I walked over, but I certainly walked over it a few times.
Yeah.
But then to hear the story, to read in your book the story about it, and then to see the picture of them from the back cover, which for what some reason I always assumed was on Primrose Hill, kind of across the street, but I was incorrect about that. And then to see the spot, I'm like, well, I would have gone to that spot, you know, the same picture with you and your buddy that you took there. I'm like, hey, man, I could have done that. So just knowing some of these spots, or, you know, on Talbot Road or whatever, where the Yes headquarters were, you know, or, you know, where some of the other studios, like I would have gone to Ad Vision. I just wish I'd had it back in the day, because the detail you have on here is amazing, sir.
Yeah, it was great. And going round with my son, who's a professional photographer, and we went round on the thing that I called my own Tormato, where I went mm-hmm. round all the sites in London, was fantastic. And what really struck us was how close they all are to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all within about a mile and a half, 2 miles of each other, all these different places in the story, even places where the guy who created the harpsichord for Madrigal lived mm-hmm. in Pont Street, and that wasn't far away either. So everything was very, very closely concentrated around a sort of central point of Regent's Park, as you said, where they took the photographs, which you see on the back there.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic to see the places and to relive some of those things. And I posed for some photographs and pretended to be the band and those sorts of things. This was good fun.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And the detail you go into in here is really extraordinary, Kevin. I really have to congratulate you here, because, you know, I have aspirations to write a book. It's like, well, one day I'd like to share some of my passion and knowledge of rock and roll. But you have to be, you can't just be, here's what I like in rock and roll. You know, you have to be a little specific. You have to dial down, like, okay, so I need to do an era of a band rather than just a band, like, and an album would be great, but which album do I love so much that I could get in the detail that you have here? I mean, talk about digging up all these amazing photos and details about their instruments. I mean, going into the detail on Steve's Broadcaster that he used and that he kind of regrets changing, because it was one of the original Broadcaster, which I guess would become the Telecaster. Yeah. And like, so I probably shouldn't have messed that up, but I still got the sound that I wanted, so I don't have any regrets there. And learning about the Birotron, which I want you to kind of tell our listeners about, you know, Rick's venture there and its purpose and kind of its history. It's kind of amazing. I'm like, I don't have the knowledge or the patience to go into the detail on one album like you have here. It's really pretty extraordinary. I mean, amazing for Yes fans, but I think people who like the technology of rock and roll will really love your book.
Well, thank you very much. It's one of those things, and I was thinking about it the other day when someone asked me a similar question about it. And it's two things. First of all, I love digging into things. And mm-hmm. I wanted to know what the instruments were which managed to make these really odd sounds, some of them on the record. And, you know, I first heard the record when I was 13, and it blew my mind completely. I never heard anything like it at all. And if you think about the sound, for example, that Chris Squire got mm-hmm. On this album, he never before or since really did he have this exactly the same kind of sound. So what was it about his sound, and how did he get it, and why did he try and do it? And the North drums that Alan White used.
Yes.
Why did he use those? Just because they looked amazing, or was there something else behind it?
Sure.
And what was this drum synthesizer that I saw mentioned? But there is nowhere that you can see on the album or in the literature that'll tell you who created the drum synthesizer and what it was. So I had to dig very deeply to find that. But the thing that you mentioned there, the Birotron, is an amazing story. And Chris Dale is the expert who has spent many years now working on wrecked Birotrons and trying to resurrect the whole thing from that. So the basic idea behind the Birotron was to create a more usable, more reliable, more flexible version of the Mellotron. So the Mellotron is the archetypal progressive rock instrument, and it creates so much of the atmosphere and keyboard color of so many of our favorite records. But what Dave Biro wanted to do, that's the guy who invented it, was to create something that would address some of the limitations of the Mellotron. So as you may know, the Mellotron works on loops of tape, but when you hold down the Mellotron keys, it can only play for 8 seconds.
8 seconds,
that's
yeah.
The length of the tape. And once it gets to the end of that tape, it has to rewind itself and you have to go back to the beginning. So that seriously reduces the creativity that you can have when you're using a Mellotron, and it makes you play in a particular way.
Sure.
So what he decided to do was to still use the tape loop idea. And this was before digital days, of course. So it was the only sort of way you could do this. But instead of using a loop of tape, which then had to be rewound, he used 8-track tapes. So exactly the same tapes as you have in an 8-track tape recorder player. Okay. They used those. And the idea was to have music shops stocking these tapes. So you could go in and buy a new set of sounds for your Birotron, take it home and stick it in, and away you go with a completely new orchestra set of tapes or whatever it was that you wanted. And this was a great idea, and he patented the idea, and he showed it to Rick Wakeman. And Rick Wakeman was very, very interested in this idea, and he thought it was, it will be a fantastic successor to the Mellotron, because the tape loop, for example, is continuous in an 8-track player.
Right.
So if you hold a chord down or hold a note down on a Birotron, it will play forever until you
take
your hands off the instrument again.
And then it rewinds, right?
No, it doesn't rewind. It just keeps going.
Oh, okay.
It's a continuous loop tape.
Oh, wow.
So it will just keep going forever. And that was brilliant. And the fact that you could swap in and swap out those tapes and get an immediately completely different set of sounds that you could play from the Birotron seemed like a fantastic idea. Now, the problem with it was that they were aiming for a desktop machine rather than the Mellotron. And of course, one of the problems with the Mellotron is that every time you try and move it, it's so huge and so heavy and so cumbersome. It just goes out of tune and everything goes wrong when you try and move the things. Very, very delicate instruments. So therefore, there were many, many stories of Mellotrons going wrong in concert. So, which meant that, because they wanted to make it smaller, neater, easier to transport, that meant that everything had to be miniaturized. And these were components which had never been miniaturized before. There were only a few companies in the world that could do this work. Everything had to be precision engineered, and components for this Birotron prototype, which had never been created before to the specifications that they needed to be. So it was an extremely long and extremely difficult and excessively expensive process.
Right.
And good old Rick Wakeman, as he's done so many times in his career, sank loads and loads of his own money into this because he thought it was going to be such a wonderful instrument. And he, in fact, ended up buying the patent. So if you look in the patent books, Rick Wakeman is down as holding the patent for the Birotron in 1978 when Tormata was constructed. And however, it failed, and it failed, and I asked Rick about this recently, it failed simply because just around the corner, 1980, 1979, 80, 81, digital musical equipment started appearing.
Right.
And so everything based on tape was just immediately obsolete.
That's right.
So the Birotron company only ever produced a few Birotrons, and they were only ever produced as prototypes. No actual production models were ever produced, any instruments at all. So there are only a few Birotrons left in the world, and what Chris Dale has done is just amazing. He's collected together all the bits and pieces of broken, smashed up Birotrons and put them together into one working unit. And the other thing he's done, which is even more complicated, is to recreate the original sounds. So as you can imagine, with 40-year-old 8-track tapes,
right,
they had disintegrated, almost disintegrated completely. So he had to rebuild those. And he's had to digitize the original sounds, patch them up where the gaps are, and create brand new 8-track cartridges with the original sounds on it. So he's taken a huge amount of time, energy, and he's done an amazing job on that. And so Rick Wakeman doesn't have a Virutron anymore. Chris Dale has got one that, as I say, he's recreated almost from scratch, from the...
It's kind of Frankensteined it together, yes?
Yeah, that's right. So, and that's just one of the instruments on the album, which I've become somewhat obsessed with trying to find out about how all the instruments were put together and how they worked.
Well, one thing that really struck me about this book is you mentioned before, you said, well, you know, you understand how the Mellotron works. Mm. No, I had no idea. This book goes into such great detail on stuff like right. that. Well, you mentioned, you know, it had a finite amount of time, and you said if you go back and listen to Strawberry Fields, you can hear where it runs out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and do that now because I want to hear that. What I really like about this book is that even if you were not familiar with Tormato, even if you weren't really a huge fan of Yes, you could read this book and get a lot of information, a real deep dive into the instruments that they play, the way that they put this record together, and just kind of the recording, what was happening at the time, both with the band and kind of, you know, records in general. You know, after the punk thing came out, Yes was kind of in a strange area as far as what they wanted to do. And this chronicles how it all came together with what we know as the album now.
Yes, and it was fascinating. And the person who really spurred me on to create the book was Peter Woolerscroft. And I managed to find him. So his name is on the back of Tormato. And he was the tape op, so it was his job to look after all the takes. So when you think that there were 35 different takes of On the Silent Wings of Freedom, and it was his job to keep all those together. So when Chris Squire said, "Oh, let's take the first 2 minutes of take 6 and splice it together with tape 35," it was Peter's job to make sure that happened. And amazing character and a lovely guy. And he came on onto the podcast. And the thing which, as I say, kicked me off was the fact that he wrote diaries of his time at AdVision when he was tape op and everything that he did. And so he has a very good set of recollections about exactly what Yes did, how they behaved, how they tried to set up the studio in the first place, although it didn't work, and everything that went into creating those backing tracks at AdVision. Peter was an amazing guy to talk to.
Yeah, no, and talking about how a lot of people feel that the mix is murky, it's flat. Even Rick is like, you know, this didn't turn out the way it should have. And talking about what they did at AdVision versus RAK, just even though technical details about, we all talk about the masters. Okay, well, we're going to remaster something, or we're going to put in a new mix. We've got to get the masters to do that. Even him talking about the difference between, and some of the other folks, the difference between the master tape.
The multi-tracks.
The multi-track, yes, thank you. The difference between master tape and multi-track tape. To the average person, they're like, huh? But just that difference is huge, you know? And where are those then? Are they in the vaults? Did they get destroyed in the Universal Fire? Are they sitting in Chris Squire's estate's basement somewhere, you know? Who knows, you know, but you, Mr. Detective, have tracked all this down and we know this stuff now. It's kind of amazing.
Yes. And that was a great conversation we had with Brian Cahew, and he was responsible for getting the additional, the expanded version, extra songs, which appear on both Tormato. And he also did the drama expanded and remastered version. He didn't do the remastering. He just did the hunting around in the vaults for anything which was usable, which they could release on those expanded versions. And Brian is a fascinating character anyway, because he also put together the Progeny box set. And so it was his job to, he put together and revamped and remastered all the Progeny recordings, which was an amazing undertaking. And that's slightly off the topic of what we're talking about today. But if you have a chance to go and listen to the episode of the Yes Music podcast with Brian Cahew, it's fascinating to see what he did to scrub up those recordings. But yes, he was the one who pointed out to me the differences between master tapes and multi-track tapes. Mm-hmm. So when Stephen Wilson did the remasters and remixes, critically, of the 5 Yes albums that he did,
right,
he was able to go back to the original not master tapes, but the original multi-track tapes, which meant that he could boost Chris Squire's bass part or choose a completely separate bass take and splice that in and make it sound the way he wanted to make it. So that's why there are such significant differences between his remixes and the original. So, in fact, Brian told us that, as you might imagine, in the recording business, master tapes is a bit of a strange term and means different things to different people.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
So master tapes to most people means the first stereo definitive mix, and that's a master tape, and they put that aside and they keep it, and they might copy it straight away and keep it so that the original intentions are always kept, and then put it in a vault and you can go back to it afterwards, as opposed to the multi-track tapes, which, as the name sounds, are all the individual parts. And so when you see something like a documentary, like the Classic Albums documentaries, where they sit at the mixing console and they're able to mess around with the faders and listen just to the isolated drums or the isolated whatever's on those tracks, you could do that. So that's what you need in order to fundamentally remix albums, or at least it was until very recently. And the technology which was developed for the recent Beatles documentary film, that's right. That technology will in the future allow you to do a lot more in terms of remixing if you don't have the individual tracks. However, that's what we are talking about when we say, were the master tapes or the multi-track tapes for Tormato lost or destroyed? And Brian Cahew, as I say, had that job of finding additional versions of songs and different songs that were released that weren't released on the original album. And so he went into the Warner Brothers tape vault and he got those. And it was his job, as I say, to look for additional things. But at the same time, he did see the original multi-track tapes for the albums as well. So he was able to confirm to us that the Tormato multi-track tapes are not lost. They are in there and they could be used to remix the album if there was ever a really compelling reason to do that. And, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? Is there a compelling reason to do that? Well, only if you could persuade as many Yes fans as possible to buy the probably rather expensive new version of Tormato if they did do it. So there's got to be a commercial incentive to it in the end. And I don't think there has been that, combined with the fact that Yes themselves, the members of the band on the record, are not particularly keen on the record anyway.
Right.
It's probably not going to be at the top of their list to remix.
You know, but it's interesting. You said in the beginning of this book that I believe you came to this record and 90125 at the same time. And Oliver Wakeman kind of said the same thing in the foreword that he wrote, that this was kind of the first record that he got into. So we talk about this, I don't know, phenomenon, I guess, the stuff that imprints on you as when you first start to listen, like you'll always have a special place in your heart for that. Mm. And I kind of feel like from this book, there are people who really do hold this record in high regard just because it is kind of the one-off. I think you said in the promo stuff for 90125 and Big Generator, they didn't even mention this record.
Yeah, which is bizarre.
Yeah, like it never happened.
Yeah, that's right. So there were three consecutive tour books or tour programs, 90125, Big Generator, and then I always forget what the third one is.
Talk or Union?
Yeah, Union, isn't it, I think. And those three books don't mention Tormato as ever having existed. It's left out from the discography. And that's partly because at the time Tormato was out of print. So going into a record store, you couldn't have got a copy. But it's also partly because, well, you can guess, can't you, on other yes. reasons, because the band weren't particularly proud of it. Fortunately, it is back in print, and I go through in the book all the different versions, all the different formats which have come out over the years. And I had a very amusing couple of days where I listened to nine different versions, nine different formats of the album and wow. gave my thoughts about which is the best. I won't tell you just now. You'll have to read the book to see
That's
which
right.
I think is the best. But yeah, it was fascinating to go through all those different formats. And, you know, it's great that it has come back from that that period of not being released again. And when CDs came about, I mean, it eventually got a CD release. It wasn't one of the first tranche of Yes albums to get that CD release. And I remember buying a copy of 90125 on CD. It was one of the first CDs I had, actually. And that was an 83, 84. But Tormato didn't have a release until about 89, I think.
Gotcha.
On CD.
And of course, now they have all these, as you call them, bonus tracks. And the fact of the matter is, on the course of doing this record and at both studios, they basically made a record and a half, or maybe even two records worth of material. And I'm a sucker for a good B-side or an unreleased track that you've never heard on the radio or something like that. So yeah, they've basically got a whole second record here. Of all of those, which one is your favorite?
Of the additional?
Of the additional, right. Not the main tour model, but from Abilene down to, you know, the extras.
I mean, in terms of the music on it, I quite like the one with the Dennis Healy, Rick Wakeman skit on it. Which one is that?
Is that the second song? I'm trying to remember.
Is that Money?
Money, yeah. Of course. That's exactly what it is. From the point of view of what the instruments are doing on that song, that's my favorite one. as I say in the book, the comedy routine that Rick does over the top of that is best forgotten, frankly. And it's a shame it wasn't mixed out completely in the process, because it's one of Rick's, you know. And if you sort of multiply what Rick usually does in his comedy by the political and non-PC type 1978, then yeah, it's pretty offensive in some ways. But so yeah, what the musicians are doing on that, what the instruments are doing, I really like. But yeah, not too keen on the comedy.
Well, no, and I guess, you know, like Pink Floyd has a money song, ABBA's got a money song. Do we really need one? I don't know. But that's grumpy old Rick for you, I guess. I mean, someone who seems to be upset all the time about something, and yet he's hilarious. He's a very, very funny man. I mean, what would you tell us from your interactions with Rick that maybe the average person might not get from all of his funny interviews or TV hostings over the years? What did you take away from your conversations with Rick?
Yeah, I mean, he's an extremely generous, as I have found all the Yes members that I've spoken to over the years. Rick is a very, very generous character, and he is always he always stresses how much he values his time in Yes. He's not one of those people that leaves the band and then slags them off continually. Mm-hmm. He is very keen on every iteration of the band, because he sees it as a legitimate part of the band's history. So he would never bash a particular lineup. That's not his style at all. And he's most proud, and you can see this by the fact that he keeps coming back to Yes Music. So his most recent concert series that he's announced for next February, he's doing his delve back into Yes Music, and he wouldn't be doing that if he wasn't proud of what he achieved. And he was also someone who, if you think about when he came back into the band 2002, he was happy to play things like Magnification. He mm-hmm. doesn't bear grudges musically at all. And that was, you know, that's one of the things that I got from him. But also his love of all different kinds of music as well. And of course, he's a classically trained keyboardist, classically trained piano player. And digging into his part on Madrigal, for example, was fascinating for the book, because there's a great story about him at the Royal College of Music, sneaking in and playing the harpsichord when he wasn't supposed to, because you were only supposed to play that harpsichord if you were doing harpsichord as your main study. And he wasn't. He was doing piano, but he snuck in there anyway and started to play it. And the story goes that an old guy walked up and asked him what he was doing. And he was saying, "Oh, I'm playing this harpsichord." And the guy said to him, "Well, why are you playing that particular harpsichord?" And Rick said, "Well, that's because it's a Gough harpsichord and they're the best." And it turned out that the guy talking to him was Gough himself.
Wow.
So his instrument. And yeah, it's those sorts of things that, alongside the amazing musicianship, the virtuosic abilities of Rick. Yes, he's a real person. He's a warm, friendly individual. Maybe sometimes people don't like all of his comedy, as we've just been talking about, but that's fine. That's just one of those things, isn't it? He's a really warm and open and generous person. So when I was trying to get some comments from him for the book, and I happened to know Oliver, which is his son, and that's why we got him to do the foreword, and I only know him through talking to him on the podcast about his music and his part in Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he got straight onto his dad and said, "Please answer these questions that
Kevin sent in."
And he was very, very happy to do so, despite the fact that he was rehearsing for yet another concert tour when I sent those through to him. So you know, very generous, very likable, very friendly individual.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up that he holds no grudges, because I've seen him I can't remember what the documentary was. It was when Chris was still with us. But he's talking about how he's glad about 90125, even though he was not a part of that. He's like, this is the album that has sustained the band and allows us to continue to visit this. I don't feel like Steve Howe is the same way. And I can tell that he does not like to play stuff that he was not on. And it's not a lot. It's not in a lot of their sets. And it's he kind of downplays it. And I, even on the Union tour, it's like, oh, well, if they're playing a song from 90125, I'm just going to get off of stage. I'm like, well, come on, man. Everyone except you, maybe, Steve, has raved about how maybe the Union album was not great, because there's really kind of two albums they kind of squished together, but the tour they all love. And you can see Rick in those videos. He's really interacting with Trevor Rabin. And like, well, he and Trevor were never together in Yes before Union, and obviously they have been in Anderson, Rabin, Whitman, but it's like, he didn't know this guy, but it's like, he looked like he was having fun with this guy who's more of a riff master than, you know, the technical prowess of Steve Howe. Would you agree with what I'm saying?
Yes, I think you're right. The thing about Steve is that he, you know, musically, he is very clear about, yes, what he likes, what he doesn't like, what he's prepared to do, what he's not prepared to do. And as you say, he's not keen on playing Yes songs that he wasn't on. And frankly, he's not keen on playing some Yes songs that he was on.
Yeah.
So when I spoke to him about On the Silent Wings of Freedom, which they brought back, and I very much enjoyed. I managed to see them last year at the Royal Albert Hall, and it was a fantastic
I was there,
concert.
Man. I was there.
Oh, you were there. Fantastic.
Yeah, I was there. Lisa Wetton sat right behind me.
Ah, right. Fantastic, yeah.
But what a special night that was, yeah?
It was wonderful. But I asked him specifically why they had left the introduction out. So one of the best things about that song for me, and I suppose most other Yes fans who like it, is the amazing Chris Squire introduction, the bass solo essentially at the start of that song, and he left it out. And I asked him on the podcast exactly why they left it out, and he was very clear that he was very unhappy with his own playing. He had improvised those parts at the beginning. He wasn't happy with what was happening between him and Rick Wakeman on that album, and you know, he's very sure that both of them were trying to outdo each other and play in the same sort of oral space as each other and all that kind of stuff. And so he's ended up hating what he did himself at the beginning of that song. And so he was very specific. He said, "I'm not going to sit down and learn parts that I don't like. Even if they're my parts, even if I created them, I'm still not going to do it, and no one's going to persuade me to do it." So the rest of the time that I've spoken to him, and that time as well, but all the times that we've spoken to him, again, he's come over as a really generous, kind individual and has spoken very openly about the things we've asked him about. But he has boundaries, doesn't he? You know,
yes.
he won't go past that. And, you know, in some ways, I think he's right. So the first time I saw Yes was on the Open Your Eyes tour. So I'm relatively recent. That was in 1998. And Yes, he handed over to Billy Sherwood, who at the time was playing some guitars and some keyboards
right.
for the band rather than bass as he does now, of course. He handed over to him for the Owner of Lonely Heart solo. And I thought that was a very good plan, actually, because Steve, when he does that sort of a solo, and he grudgingly has done that solo and that Trevor Rabin song, he puts his own stamp on it. He tries to play it in his own way. But frankly, I don't think it really comes off brilliantly. Mm-hmm. And so he knows what he's capable of. He knows what he likes doing. So in the end, I don't blame him for not wanting to play things that he doesn't think shows his abilities off. So, you know, that's fine. But as I say, he's always been absolutely delightful to us when we've interviewed him.
Talking about Steve Howe, one of the things that really struck me in the book was the talking about all the different guitars that he used, but especially the Les Paul, and kind of going down that rabbit hole. There's a gentleman who bought it
yes.
a couple of years ago and actually has a YouTube video where he takes it apart.
Yes.
And it's like 25 or 30 minutes long. I watched every second of that.
Yeah.
Like, really? And then this. And then he goes through every single part. But the coolest thing is when he's showing you, I don't know what fret it is, the 12th fret or whatever, that's got the eye. It looks like it's an eye.
Mm.
And you can see that on the Heat of the Moment video. And you can see it in the Don't Kill the Whale also, the guitar itself. Mm. And to think it wasn't a model. It wasn't the same. It was exactly the same guitar that made those sounds. Yeah. We are huge Asia fans here.
That's
on
right.
this show.
Right. Yes.
And to think that was the guitar that made those sounds. It's just, I mean, again, I'm going back to the fact that this book can lead you down a lot of different rabbit holes. If you want to nerd out on like technology or gear, anything like that, it's fascinating.
It's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we loved speaking to Fernando Perdomo, who came to talk to us about the guitars. And he's such an enthusiastic guy. We couldn't shut him up. He just kept going and going and going about the guitars. And we've only talked to him about Steve Howe's guitars, of course, and on Tomato specifically, but we need to have him back on the show to talk about Trevor Rabin's guitars, which he knows about. And he's also a huge fan of Peter Banks and knows everything there is to know about his guitars. So that, you know, that's going to be another amazing experience. But in terms of the basses as well, just talking about guitars generally for the book, we spoke to Miguel Falcao, who is an amazing bassist himself, and has done dozens and dozens of bass covers of Chris Squire. And I took up the bass guitar myself because I saw what Miguel was showing me about Chris Squire. So I got hold of a bass and started copying Miguel's covers of Chris Squire. But yeah, Miguel went into it again, a huge amount of detail about the Rickenbacker bass and the Thunderbird bass that also appears on Tormato. But not only that, the board, the effects board, and the bass pedals that Chris Squire used. And what kicked me off with that was Dave Watkinson took a photograph of the setup, of the Tormato bass setup, when he visited Rack Studios in 1978, and was left by Mickey Most to roam around with his brother in the studio for about 2.5 hours before Yes turned up.
Unbelievable. That's a great story.
It's an amazing story, and Dave's a wonderful guy. But what we did was we managed to persuade Dave for the first time since 1978 to digitize those photographs. And we saw a huge amount more detail in those photographs than had ever been seen before. So 1978 analog snapshots, which have been scrubbed up specifically for this book. And so we can see exactly what the pedals were, exactly how it all fitted together that Chris was using there and on stage on the Tormato and the 10 True Summers tours. So we know exactly what he was doing and exactly how he got those sounds, which is what Miguel Falcao helped us with. So yeah, so many people have helped us to understand more about the album.
Hi, this is Jeff Downs. You're listening to The Ugly American Werewolf.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
It's an amazing in-depth book. I mean, some real detective work on your part to piece all of this together. And that's why I think even if you're not a huge fan of Tormato, you like Yes, but you're not, you're going to love this book. And even if you're not, like Jackson said, you may not even have to be a huge Yes fan, but if you like to get in depth about how these things are made and where they're made and the sounds they came out, you're going to love it. I mean, I totally recommend it. And I do want to get into the tunes a little bit here with you, because I mean, I bought the Yes, like, you know, all the discs remastered in the little clamshell kind of thing with the new Roger Dean artwork on it. So, you know, I've listened to Tormato and the bonus tracks a couple times over the years, not as many times as you have.
I know.
But I think most people know Don't Kill the Whale because either they've heard it on the radio. I mean, it got into the top 40 in the UK back in the day. It was a big hit. Well, it was a bit of a hit for them over the years. But, I mean, some of the work on here, even though the mix kind of turned some people off, there's still some amazing stuff on here, like Madrigal, you know, with Rick playing the harpsichord, you know, it's a little Baroque medieval, an incredibly short song for a Yes song, but beautiful. And I still think it fits. You can say, well, that's a weird one. I'm like, well, not for Yes. UFO is kind of a weird one. Right. I mean, or Circus of Heaven. That's a weird one. Right. You know, I mean, I like and I think it ends very strongly. A lot of people like, OK, the last few songs, we'll just put the worst couple songs at the end. But I think Onward, which is a Squire composition, which is kind of amazing, is the second to last song. And then we mentioned on the Silent Wings of Freedom, which they brought back for the last tour, is an amazing way to finish this album. Very strong, the last two songs, where, you know, whereas there's a couple of odd ones before that. I
think you're right. I think there's a lot of gems in there, and I think people do tend to focus on Arriving UFO and Circus of Heaven. They are odd. They certainly are odd. And Fernando Perdomo's comment about the album, to sort of sum it up, was he said that the overriding feeling you get from it is quirky. And I think that's a good word. But the problem is that they weren't going for quirky.
Yeah.
They were. And so things like Circus of Heaven definitely ended up not being quite as they had hoped it would be, I think. And obviously driven by John Anderson, and his lyrics in that and Arriving UFO are some of the oddest lyrics that he ever came up with. And I enjoyed sort of digging into those lyrics and the way they work and the way they work with the sound that was created. I actually quite like Arriving UFO. It's very definitely, you know, 1978 and those synthesized very early, very, very early synthesized drums, mm-hmm. and effects that are on there. But yeah, we have to remember that that was science fiction in 1977, 78 was huge.
Right.
Because you had Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Star Wars the year before Tormata came out. So it was very much top of everyone's minds. So I think it was a good, or it should have been a good sort of marketing ploy to include those in there. And of course, on the Tormata tour, they played Close Encounters of the Third Kind theme music to introduce the concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when more used to Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra and Firebird. But yes, they changed it up for that. And I think that was all around this idea of science fiction and fantasy.
Arriving through the eons of time's immortal power of the future to behold.
And it's very trippy and proggy in some parts, and they're playing with everyone's playing with their new toys on this, when you kind of tell. And Rick's trying to make some cool stuff. It's just, I was surprised to find that Steve co-wrote this, because he's not super prominent. At least I don't always hear him that well in this mix, you know?
No, you're right. And I mean, when we've spoken to various people on the podcast about writing credits, they always point out that it's really for convenience. It's really to make sure that they've split up the royalties sensibly. So did the people named actually write the bulk of those songs? We will never know. But So that's one point. But yes, you're right. That is true, that he's not particularly prominent on that song. Just about Magical, though, I think that's a fascinating song, and I think Rick is still keen on what he did there. Mm. And we spoke to a guy called James Gardner about Magical and about the use of the harpsichord, which has then sent me down another huge rabbit hole about harpsichords and how they work and the development of them and the Thomas Goff harpsichords and all that. But that's I found that all absolutely fascinating and wonderful. But that, I think, something that which is easy to overlook on Tormata is the orchestration. So the orchestration was done by Andrew Price Jackman, who also did the orchestration on Fish Out of Water, Chris's classic solo album.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated because I've always loved that orchestration. So there's some strings on Madrigal and also on Onward, of course, Onward with the French horn solo there as well. And I've always loved that stuff. But when I mentioned it to Rick Wakeman, he's actually, I didn't realize, he had intended to do those orchestrations himself.
Yeah.
And he was rather upset that he didn't get the chance to. So again, what would that have done to the album?
Right.
How different could that have been if he'd got his hands on the orchestrations? And so, you know, he views it as water under the bridge, as it's 45 years ago. But no, he really wanted to do that himself. But I've always loved that. And I think that's Onward would be a great, beautiful love song without that. But I think adding that orchestration, and particularly the French horn solo, I think elevates that song. Mm-hmm. Much, much further than it would have been. And I just love it. And of course, you can't think about Onward now without imagining in your mind's eye the tributes to Chris Squire, his Rickenbacker bass in the middle of the stage with a single spotlight on it. It was very deeply affecting, that, and a great, of course, great loss of both him and Alan White. But yeah, and that there are some real powerhouses, aren't there, on the album, which again, I think people forget. So Release, Future Times, Rejoice Itself, and the last song, On the Silent Wings of Freedom, are all really strenuous. And that's why a lot of those songs didn't survive very long to play live, because they were too frenetic. There was too much in them. There's too much energy involved in recreating those live, and which is a shame, because I think those are real rocking numbers and would stand up very well in a Yes concert today, even.
Mm-hmm.
said my friend of a distant life, covered in greens of a golden age, set in stone, follow me. He sounded of dreams supreme, follow me. Drifting within the glow and the afterglow of the eve. And if the firelight, I could match thee in a flame.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, release. I mean, wasn't it a single in Canada, maybe?
Yeah, so this is... I've got into trouble on social media by mentioning this. People have got very upset with me for some reason. I don't know why. Anyway, so the single "Don't Kill the Whale" was released in the UK and most other places with Abilene on the B side,
right.
And that's how it was. However, in the US, the B side was release. So, and if you look at something like the promo copy of the single in America, it doesn't have a side A and a side B referenced at all.
Oh. So
maybe at some point the idea was to have it released as a double A side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. It's not clear. But certainly anyone that you speak to from the US and say, you know, what was the single from Tormato, they'll always say it's Don't Kill the Whale, which is fine. But officially in Canada, they were swapped around and release was the A side in Canada, and Don't Kill the Whale was the B-side, and that was the same in the Philippines, allegedly. I've never been able to confirm that, in the same way as I've never been able to confirm that there is a 12-inch version of the single. It's written down somewhere, but that doesn't make it true,
right.
And I've certainly never found a copy of it. So yes, release. I think could have been another great single. I would have preferred there to be at least two singles from the album myself.
Well, I guess, yeah, they tried to play it live, and they're like, yeah, we're going to swap this out for something else, which is too bad because, you know, I mean, obviously it was the part where they pipe in the audience noise, the cheering fans or whatever, so Alan can do his drum thing. But that's killer. I mean, what Alan did was great. I mean, there's some sick bass from Chris at the end. I'm like, yeah, this is very Yes. This is this absolutely fits in their whole catalog. They should have tried to play this live, but I guess it was just a bit of an undertaking. They said, we've got other stuff we can do, which obviously fit.
Yeah.
Speaking of playing live, what I didn't realize is that this was one of the first times anyone had ever incorporated a round stage into a rock star rock show. We we went and saw Def Leppard on the 92 Adrenalized tour where they used that, and we thought, oh, this is the first, you know, Def Leppard was the first. Nope. Yes had beat them to the punch. Just interesting thinking about how it played out, not only getting the fans a better view of the band, but also selling more front row tickets was an interesting idea too.
Yeah, so this was Michael Tate who came up with the idea for the rotating stage, who was the lighting and scenery and had all those sorts of things, and is a legendary figure now, really, for those aspects of concerts. But it was his idea for the rotating stage, and part of it, he's quite open about it nowadays, was that you could have an immensely long front row.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the photographs that I've got in the book shows that, you know, so many more people are close to the stage, close to the action, as it were. And fascinating that they brought the concept back for the Union Tour, because again, they wanted to get as many people as possible close to their heroes. And I think it went really well. I mean, it did break down once or twice.
Of course.
Very famously, that they they got the quite handy to have that very large number of people right close to the stage, because they managed to get them to come and rotate the stage when the machinery broke down. And so the whole of the front couple of rows was empty because the fans were pushing the stage.
They were actually turning the stage.
Yeah. but yes, it's a fascinating thing. And the other one that I know a lot, not a lot about, but the other one I know of is the Peter Gabriel rotating stage from many years later. And it's fascinating to see the differences between those two stages. But of course, for the roadies, it was a nightmare because they were underneath the stage for the whole of the
time. That was the other thing, too. It, famously, the Def Leppard stage had a lot of room underneath the stage for all kinds of shenanigans. But it didn't look like the Yes stage. Like, I guess they had to kneel or something. Yeah. And it looked very uncomfortable.
Yes, they had to kneel. And eventually there was a bit of a protest from the stagehands underneath the stage because they were kneeling and crawling around, literally crawling around for the whole time. And in those days, of course, shows were rather longer than they are recently. but they were crawling around, and eventually they said, look, we're not going to do this anymore unless you put some carpet in for us to protect our knees a bit better. So they did actually put some carpet in under there for them. But again, something else, Jeremy North is a friend of mine who went to the, I suppose it was the, yeah, it was the first time that stage was ever used, was in Wembley, the Wembley concerts in 1978. And he took some amazing photographs of that concert. And again, we digitized those and we were able to zoom in much further than had previously been done. And you can see a hatch. There were some grills in the stage which could be popped open and they could hand guitars out and so on. But there's a bit like that you see in the footlights in a theater. There's a little hatch, and in one of his photographs you can see the head of one of the roadies. Yeah. Which is really fascinating to see him there. And so that was a kind of spy hole that they had. They could stick their head up through this gap and see what was happening on stage and make sure everything was going well. So yeah, it was a fascinating thing. And that they kept using, of course, on the drama tour. They used the same stage, but they did say, and I won't tell you that story because I think that's a great story about how they managed to appear, the band appeared as if by magic on the top of that rotating stage for the drama tour, because they had always intended to do that. So for the Tour Marceau and the 10 True Summers tour with the rotating stage, the band wanted to appear as if by magic on the stage and were not having to walk through the audience like they did in the end. And this was all part of their concept of the 11th Illusion, which was the working title of Tour Marceau before they settled on Yes Tour and then Tour Marceau. That's another story. Yes. But so they had this idea of creating visual illusions. But they didn't manage to do it for that tour, but they did manage to do it on the drama tour with a rather different lineup of the band, of course.
Yes, yes. And so just quick side question here for you, because when Union came out, I was kind of fascinated. That's when Jax and I were like graduating from high school, going into college, starting to become friends. The fact that they had this in the round spinning thing was fascinating to me. It's like, I wasn't a huge Yes fan at that time, but I thought that would be a killer show to see. Now, I have seen video. They released a video, but I think it was from Miami or Sunrise, Florida, where they did the end stage. They did not. The video does not have the in the round. Is there an in the round video from that tour that you have access to or that you've seen?
I'm pretty sure that there is some video. I don't know how.
I don't think it's officially released.
No, video. I don't think there's an official one. But yes, that's something else to dig into, isn't it? Yeah, I'm sure I have seen a video of that round stage, which was not the same round stage, of course. They created a new one, but yeah, fascinating stuff. And fascinating that now there is one venue, I forget the name of it now, in the US, which is permanently set up as a rotating circular stage, and Yes did play there quite recently.
Interesting. Well, I'd love them to do an official release. It's a fascinating time for the band. I mean, it's the one lineup where you kind of have to have something like that because you kind of have two of everything. And, there's two drummers, two keyboards. It makes sense to give everybody an opportunity to see everybody.
So yeah.
I just wish they would. I mean, and I'm not a huge fan of the album Union. I don't know that anyone in the band is. I don't know how many fans really are. But that tour was something special that I think everyone really enjoyed. Except for maybe our friend Steve Howe.
Well, there you go.
Well, listen, Kevin, I thank you so much for spending some time with us here, and congratulations on the book. I think it's very well done. It's incredibly well researched. And even the photos can give you some great detail that not everyone has seen before. Why don't you tell everybody where they can get it and how they can order it?
So here it is again. Yes, The Tomato Story by me and with the foreword by the wonderful Oliver Waitman. So that's the book. Now, if you're in the EU or in the UK, the best way to get hold of a copy is via the Burning Shed website, because they have been doing the pre-order for me and have been sending them out. Now, if you're overseas from me, of course, the postage and packing is quite expensive, so you might want to buy it from a local store. So Amazon have got copies, although it only went live on Amazon on Friday, and Amazon, bless them, take quite some time to catch up properly. So if you go on your local Amazon store, you might find it there and easily available. You might have to wait a little bit, a few days, for them to get their act together. It's a print-on-demand book, which means that it'll be printed locally to you if you buy it from an online store, and you know, therefore saving all the carbon and all that. And it certainly won't run out. They will never run out. They are printed to order. But the other thing about the book is that because it's printed on demand, there are only black and white photographs in it, because it was just vastly expensive to do it any other way. Sure. So what I have done is created this supplement, which I've called Colour Supplement, which has got a lot of the important colour photographs from the book reproduced. So, for example, there's a whole spread about the Birotron there. Okay. And the photographs from Dave Watkinson of the band in Rack Studio. So this is a nice accompaniment to the main book, and that's only available from me directly. So if you go to tomatobook.com, you can order yourself a copy of that. So the two items really go together. So it may well be that I make that available online in a different way in the future, but at the moment, tomatobook.com is the only way of getting hold of that supplement.
Gotcha. And of course, Yes Music Podcast, you can get anywhere you get your podcasts, and I assume you have no plans to quit that anytime soon.
No, I don't see why. I don't see why we would. It's going strong. And for example, we've got an interview I did for the book with this guy, Derek Dearden, who created the drum synthesizer, and that's waiting to come out. So that's going to be with us in a couple of weeks' time. And you know, there are 55 or whatever it is years of Yes history to talk about. So that's how we've managed to keep going for 12, 13 years. And yeah, no reason to stop as yet.
Thank you so much for joining us.
And many successes with the book, man. It's fantastic. It's really cool.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye for now.
That time flew by, Jackson. We didn't even get into the Hypnosis cover, or that he barely touched on the fact that it was going to be called Yes Tour, and then they changed it to Tomato because of Rick or whoever it was who threw the tomato at the proof that Hypnosis had done. Yeah,
that's, but we have to respect his time, so that may be for another episode, who knows. But just an interesting deep dive into an album that a lot of people don't really pay much attention to, outside of hardcore Yes fans.
Yeah, and you got to believe that this is the lineup. Like, if anyone's going to say, what's your favorite Yes lineup, or if you could just have one lineup, what would it be? Maybe there would be some people who would say they would prefer Bruford to White, but Alan was in the band for basically 50 years. Mm. So didn't play on all of their albums, but most all of them. But, you know, having Rick in the band is amazing. Obviously, Chris Squire would be the only bass player anyone would choose. Mm-hmm. Steve Howe's got to be the number one guitar player. And, of course, John Anderson. I mean, until, 2008 or 6 or something like that, there was only one album that didn't feature John Anderson on vocals. It was the much maligned Drama with Trevor Horn from the Buggles. But I mean, that's one that's really grown on me. I would love to talk with him about Drama sometime. because Drama obviously came right after this. And, you know, a lot of people like, different singer, forget it. I don't want to know about it. And I was probably that way at first. But there's some amazing Yes stuff on it. And Jeff is obviously fantastic. We love Jeff Downes. But Trevor does his best. On the record, he did fine. I think it was live that he started to struggle.
Yeah, and that is an interesting concept, too, because you can go through a lot of different bands who maybe had an album or two with somebody else. Mm-hmm. The one that comes to mind is Motley Crue. There was an album in 92 or 93 with John Corabi on it that just got destroyed. But then you go back and you listen, you're like, hey, this really isn't that bad of a record if you can kind of separate it out. Yeah. And I think that was, you're right, with Drama, if you give it a chance and you don't go into it with, like you said, oh, if it's not the original guy on there, I don't want to hear it. It would be interesting to get Kevin's take on that. And also the take, you were talking about, you know, the Hypnosis cover going back to Roger Dean for Drama.
Right. Yeah. So what was it that they, you know, they went away for going for the one and Tormato. They said, okay, we don't need Roger anymore. We need to change it up. We'll go to these guys, Hypnosis, who have done all sorts of amazing covers. And in the prog world, obviously. So like, I understand most people don't have the exact same person on all their covers anyways. You know, it makes sense, but I don't know. It's just Roger is so tied to it, you know, and Steve obviously has a huge relationship with him as he, I guess I can't say he opens for the band now, but he introduced the band on the last tour. And for the Steve Howe album, he obviously did the cover for that. What's that, 79 or something?
Well, and then he did the Asia stuff. And then I'm pretty sure he did the Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman and Howe cover also.
Absolutely.
So, so to me, always anything Yes was Roger Dean.
Look, being able to read this book gives me a real appreciation for this album. I mean, honestly, I like going for the one better, and then I like Drama better. Mm-hmm. And then it's a different era of the band, you could say, in the 80s. So this one, to me, I always overlooked this one, to be perfectly honest with you, despite the fact that they had the lineup that I would say that I appreciated the best. But it takes a super fan, like Kevin,
right,
who came to this as a young man, and it imprinted on him. And he's like, this is incredibly interesting. This is a very cool part of their history. And he wants to know, he's like us. He wants to know all the little details, you know, and his detail work on here is outstanding. It's really fascinating, everything that he had covered.
And it really, it one rabbit hole leads to another rabbit hole to just get into the minutia of how, you know, how they made the record, what was going on at the time, you know, going from one studio to another, the different instruments, the kind of the tension in the band. It really makes for an interesting story of how this thing came to be.
Yeah, and we didn't even get into like the back cover, you know, which they had their Yes jackets on, but Squire didn't bring his because he was late anyway, which seems to be his MO. Just all these little kind of details about it, it makes for great reading. And if you're like us who like these strange facts or hard to find details, this is a fun read, and it's one that you can do pretty quickly. I mean, I read it in a couple of days, just kind of ripped through it.
Well, and the nice part too is that there are a lot of photos in there, which help too. I mean, you look at it, you're staring down 370 pages, you're like, that's a lot. But the photos take up a lot of space on the pages in some parts, but they also really add to, you know, when he's talking about this setup. See it. Like there was one about Steve Howe's, you know, he used Fender amps.
Right.
And to see the picture of it actually set up, okay, now I see what he's talking about.
Yeah. Or, you know, like you said, the photos were digitized. So now you can zoom in some stuff and you can see some of Chris Squire's, you know, technical equipment there or whatever, or be able to zoom in on Jen Anderson's 10 string guitar, you know, or whatever it might be. Okay, here's the rack of all of Steve's stuff. Here's the North drums. Wow, that's cool stuff, man. And it just seems like it's nowhere else, right? You can't find that anyplace else.
And the thing about, you know, the everybody's got their own setup. This is the way I want my world to be. And then the sound engineer has to come in and say, sorry, fellas, this is not going to work. We've got to move this stuff around. You can't put this here because we need to get everybody recorded and not just one person. And then people get, you know, feelings get hurt. And it's just that I don't envy the guys who had to put this all together to try and manage the sound, the songwriting, and everybody's egos. I don't know if egos is the right word, but everybody's personality. while making this record.
Well, I mean, they basically didn't have a producer, right? I mean, Eddie Offord kind of split at some point. And so then, okay, we're self-producing. Well, you got five songwriters self-producing a collaborative album. I mean, no wonder there's 35 takes, you know, on the Silent Wings of Freedom. I mean, no wonder, man, because everyone has veto power over every note, right? Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, you need a dictator sometimes, you know?
You do. You have to have somebody to drive the, you know, drive the bus and tell them, no, I understand what you're saying, but this is what we're doing. We're using this take. This is how it's going to sound. This is over. We're moving on to the next thing.
And then you see their success in the 80s with Trevor Horn at the helm producing. Mm-hmm. No, he's not singing anymore, but now he's in the chair telling you what to do.
Yeah.
I'm sure that would rub some people the wrong way, but look at the results they got, at least the sales that they got, even if you don't love all those albums. And I don't love Big Generator. but it was, you know, it was trying to do something besides what we call classic Yes, is what I would say.
And I really, I like that story about, like Kevin was talking about, Rick Wakeman saying, yeah, you know, he was not on 90125 or Big Generator, but he appreciates the fact that the success, well, of 90125 carried the band for a long time and probably still does to some aspect. And he can appreciate that and be positive about it, even though he wasn't involved with it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm regretful that I never got to see Rick play with him. I have seen Oliver play with them.
Mm-hmm.
Rick was supposed to play with them on this tour when Benoit David was their singer at the time in the 2000s. And Rick couldn't do it, or he had some kind of illness. He's like, you know what? Oliver can do it. And so I was like, bummed. Oh, no, Rick. I'm like, oh, but Oliver's more than...
He's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not like he's some B-level replacement. You know, he's pretty awesome. But, I mean, to the point that I was talking with Kevin about, they did play Owner of a Lonely Heart on that. And I don't think Steve played it. And I don't know if he's trying. I don't know why he would try to play it badly. He's playing it in his own way. But see, some of the discussion in the book about why does he use those hollow body ES-175s, because he's not a riff master. He has very precise, you know, stuff. So that's why he doesn't have the Marshall amps. It's why he has the Fender amps, because you have to clearly hear each note. And then, even though he had to do a little bit of that in Asia, when Trevor was in the band, then it's a different sound. You know, it's kind of very different, but it's not just playing style. It's due to a lot of equipment that Kevin goes very in depth on.
Yeah. Yeah. Just two different styles of playing. Just, and the interesting part about how Hal was always against distortion. Distortion was kind of, you know, it lets you hide.
Exactly.
You kind of maybe fudge a little bit of a note. And his stuff is so clean that you can't make a mistake.
Well, that's right. It's incredibly precise. And that's why he won Guitar Player of the Year in that British poll of 5 or 6 years in a row, because a lot, you know, no offense to Ritchie Blackmore, a lot of people could do some of what he does. Not everyone could do what Steve does.
Correct.
Certainly not live.
Right, right. But to go back to that, the guy taking apart his Les Paul, to hear him, the owner at the time, hit those heat of the moment chords on the actual guitar, yeah, that sounds pretty good.
I know. It was another amazing video. It's like, okay, so he bought a guitar. So what? It's like, no, you can go all through this thing and show all the differences. I mean, and just talking about the broad, I didn't even know the story that the Telecaster was originally the broadcaster.
Right.
And then they got in trouble. Was it Gratch or somebody like that?
So they had a drum set that was the broadcaster. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And so because television was now a big part of life, or becoming a big part of life, I'm like, all right, let's call it the Telecaster.
If you can find that, I think what's his name's got at least one of those, John Five, because he's a big Telecaster guy.
Okay.
He's got a couple, at least one broadcaster from, I think, 1950.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is like the holy grail of, you know, because it looks exactly the same. It just, instead of Telecaster, it says broadcaster on the top of it. But it's that I really wonder if Howe is sore that he got rid of that one.
Right. Well, I think he was sore at himself for messing with it. Like, I mean, I think he got the sound he wanted out of it. But to have one of those original broadcasters is, there's some value to that, right? Not to mention it's kind of a piece of art almost. Mm-hmm. So he could probably afford to go get, you know, one of the originals if he really wanted to now. I don't know. I don't have that book, Steve's book of his guitar. So maybe he does, but just all around fascinating. And we didn't even touch on all the fascinating parts. Only so much you can do in an hour. So
right.
I would encourage fans to go out and get that book, because it'll be, your mind will be blown at some of the detail he uncovers.
And like you said, even though it's very technical, it gets into a lot of the minutia. It is actually a very easy book to read.
Yeah.
It's not, he puts it together in a way where he gives you enough, and then he kind of tells you the story of the recording, and then back to the different equipment. And he's pretty much got a chapter for all of the guys. You know, you've got the guitar, the keyboards, the bass, and the drums.
It
went by pretty fast. It was very fascinating. And you know, we watched the Get Back documentary, and you think, oh, you know, the Beatles albums, and then we talked about the Dark Side of the Moon, but all of these records had huge amounts of production put into them, and time, and just the way that it gets put together. Yeah, I could have read two books on that.
Yeah, on an album that, I mean, hey, though Roger Dean art, Kill the Whale is a good song, but it's also kind of a Prozac song. I got to go around singing, don't kill the whale. I don't know about that. And it's got the odd ones on there. You know, it's like, if you want to listen to three Yes albums, I mean, I would almost never pick that one.
Right.
You know, whereas there's 10 or 12 others that I would rotate in and out. But that one, never.
Well, that's part of your problem, too. When you put out so much prolific music, you're going to have one that kind of misses with the audience, but it doesn't mean that you can't find interesting tracks on there.
But it still went platinum in the United States, which is also kind of amazing too. In the age of punk, with a single, it's kind of a hippie protest, Don't Kill the Whale song. Now, I know they toured the heck out of it, and that always helps. And they're playing arenas and even stadiums at that point. So when you've got that many people coming to see you, it's not shocking that you could sell a million copies.
Right. Yeah, just on the name alone.
Right. Yeah. You know, and you've got this killer lineup, and they toured the heck out of the U.S. on Going for the One. I mean, it was like 85 days. Something crazy like that. Maybe that wasn't all U.S., but that's more detail that's in the book. And Wondrous Stories had done well from the previous album. So maybe it's like, oh, everyone's like, yeah, we like that one. We'll pick up this one as well. Plus, I think it was like a 10-year anniversary kind of tour, because, you know, their first album came out in 68.
Oh, okay. So yeah.
10 years of Yes, that probably helped, because everyone's like, oh yeah, I like some of the old stuff, and this is doing all right, well, I'll pick that up. But I mean, it's no mean feat to go platinum in America, and this one, despite any huge hits, did.
That's our chat with Kevin Mulrine, author of The Tormato Story and co-host of the Yes Music Podcast. Super fan of Yes, obviously, and very nice guy and a very smart guy who did a lot of research on this book, folks. Like we were saying during the show, you don't have to be an enormous Yes fan to enjoy this book and to enjoy all the knowledge that it can give you about the technology of rock and roll and the instrumentation. Really a fun read. Some great graphics and pictures in there for you, and can bring to your attention an often overlooked piece of the Yes catalog. Yeah, I mean, I got to admit that we do a lot of reviews on albums that are on their 50th or 40th or 45th or 35th anniversaries here. We like those round numbers. Tormato didn't really make our list until I saw that Kevin was doing this book. I said, you know what? We can give that record a listen, and we can give him a chance to bring his book to our listeners and try to spread the word on why he loves this album so much. I mean, versus Close to the Edge, versus Tales of Topographic Oceans, versus Fragile, versus 90125. Most people overlook this one, but it's worth giving a listen, and this book is worth picking up. You know, so go check it out, whether you get it from the YesMusicPodcast.com or you get it from Amazon or wherever you have to get it. go get it, man. Check it out and give some props to Kevin along the way, because he did an amazing job researching this, reviewing this, putting all sorts of amazing detail into this book for you. And as usual, we want to know, folks, did we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Do we miss the point? Do we leave out your favorite part? You have got to let us know. Email us. It's uglyamericanwerewolf@gmail.com. You can let us know the albums, the bands, the concerts, the DVDs, the books, the rock properties that you want to hear us talk about. And of course, you can follow us on social media. We're biggest on Twitter. It's @ugly_werewolf or @actionjack72. We're also on Instagram @ugly_American_werewolf in London. I think we're on Facebook, but not really. We have a YouTube page that you can check out. But we want you to download and subscribe wherever you get your podcast, be it Apple, iTunes, Spotify. Good Pods has been very good to us. They gave us a little gold check there, and we made a cool playlist of top 5 classic rock podcasts that you should be listening to. And I think you'll recognize some of those names if you've been listening a long time. But wherever you go, wherever you download, subscribe, please consider giving us a positive review. It just makes a huge difference to us. It helps us find more rock and roll fans like you and help us grow the show and help get more quality guests on that you want to hear from. Thanks, as always, to Pantheon Podcasts. You can check out the stable of podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. And thanks, of course, to our sponsor, RareVinyl.com, where if you use the code UGLY, you can save 10% off your order. So you want that rare first edition Yes album or something from Japan, whether it's a single or an LP or a tour poster or whatever it may be, go to RareVinyl.com, use the code UGLY, and save yourself 10%. And Burning Shed, where you can get Kevin Mulrine's book, The Tormano Story, is another great place to go for first and new prog stuff. It's a great place. I bought some stuff there over the years. So check it out. Next week, we're going to have another incredible author, one that you will probably know. If you listen to this podcast, you will know the name Mick Wall. He's been a longtime music journalist. He's been doing it for decades and decades. If you ever read Kerrang! Magazine, you read his stuff. If you ever read Classic Rock Magazine, you read his stuff. If you ever watched a Behind the Music on VH1 over the years, if it was a hard rock band, you probably saw Mick Wall on there. He's a great guy. He's got a new book about the Eagles coming out here soon that we got an advanced copy of that's very good, and we'll be talking to him about that next time. So until the next time, to all you rock and rollers all around the world, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.